Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. This episode of The Media Twits is brought to you by CUNY Graduate School of Journalism, offering an intensive, cutting-edge, three-semester Master of Arts in Journalism and a unique one-semester Advanced Certificate in Entrepreneurial Journalism, and CUNY JCamp, a series of continuing professional development workshops focused on emerging trends and skill sets in the industry. Learn more at journalism.cuny.edu. Joining me today is Rafat Ali from Boston. How are things going there?
Things are gorgeous. It's a gorgeous day outside here.
Stopped snowing on the East Coast now?
It did. Only it snowed for a day, but I was coming here yesterday on the train. I could still see a little bit of snow, but it's gorgeous here, and it still feels like fall because the leaves are still up there.
Well, that's important. So we have a great show about TV and, you know, shifting TV, which is one of the bigger topics we have. And we both have talked about cutting the cord. Neither of us have cable or satellite. But I'm curious, before we bring on the guests and start talking about this stuff, you've been pretty satisfied having just streaming TV, Roku box, Apple TV, all those things. I mean, is there something you feel is lacking or something that could be better in your experience?
No, not really. I get all the news. I'm actually more informed by not having TV. Because between online, which of course all of us go, but also streaming channels on the Roku box, streaming news channels, I think I've talked about this like five times before on our show, but
right.
Like Al Jazeera, English, CNN, International, BBC News, which actually carry news, I'm pretty informed. And
you pay for those channels on Roku, right?
No. These are free streaming channels. I don't think they're except for Al Jazeera English, I'm not sure they're technically legal, but anyway, they're streaming on Roku box. I think this, other people will feel differently. If I were a sports fanatic, I think I would surely miss a lot of the stuff. But since that's not part of what I don't really watch sports, I think all the online Roku plus Apple satisfy pretty much everything that I need. I'm sure. What about you?
For me, I agree. The sports part is always difficult to deal with, especially things that are on ESPN and cable that you can't really get on broadcast. Now in football season, most of that is on the broadcast channel, so I've been able to watch most of those things. And my hometown baseball team, the Cardinals, were in the World Series, and so that was on Fox. But then I had issues just with broadcast getting Fox in for whatever reason. And so, you know, I had foil on my antenna, and it was just a very old school experience, you know, that I thought I would never have to deal with again. And at one point, my son and I were watching the baseball game, and I'd say, you know, you need to stand for a little while so I have better reception. Oh, no, sit down. You can't stand now.
Somebody's messing with their head, that's for sure.
It's just bizarre. So it made me start questioning whether, you know, is this really worth it? Should I just get cable now or what? And then I had all kinds of meltdowns. My Roku box started kind of freezing up. And I went through just a series of tech challenges. That always seems to happen. Everything happens at once. Everything kind of fizzles out. But in general, I've been pretty happy with just the selection on Hulu Plus and on Apple TV. I don't have Apple TV, but on, either through iTunes or Netflix streaming or Netflix DVD. You know, I feel like I have enough entertainment. I'm not worried about that. Some of the sports and some of the news, I haven't really hooked up the news channels like you have, but I think it's a good idea.
Yeah, I'm guessing. I mean, as it stands now, you actually don't even need Apple TV, because what do you use Apple TV for? iTunes. I don't pay for anything on iTunes. Netflix.
Do you rent shows on iTunes?
No, I don't do that. A lot of that stuff is now increasingly becoming available on Amazon VOD. So it's interesting. I was watching the show on Bravo. What's that show on Bravo called? That's about drugs and all that stuff. That's quite Breaking Bad. So Breaking Bad, the first three seasons were on Netflix. They just came on Netflix, so that I already subscribed to, so I can watch through Roku. The fourth season, which just finished, which was the last season for the show, was not on Netflix. It's probably going to come later, but it's on iTunes as well as Amazon VOD to pay by the show. So I just I actually it's a Amazon VOD is a much more simpler experience. You can also watch online. iTunes, you have to download stuff and all that stuff. There, you can just stream it. So
Yeah,
as it
and now Amazon Prime, they just came out with this thing where you can actually borrow books like a lending library once you have it for I think it's unlimited amount of time, and you can basically borrow books or e-books.
Oh, that must be all through the libraries or through Amazon?
No, through Amazon, I think they said thousands of books are available. I don't know what the selection is exactly, but I mean you're an Amazon Prime member, so you could probably try it out and see what it's like. So anyway, so let's talk about this show. We have a couple guests on. We're going to talk about how Apple's prospects. There's been rumors that Apple might come out with its own TV set. And then, there have been talk about having these kind of apps that we see on the iPhone and iPad coming to the TV, where, a network would be or a show would be an app, and what that would be like. And we'll have Dan Frommer, who runs Splat F, technology journalist, will come on, as well as Brent Weinstein, who's head of digital media at United Talent Agency, to talk about Apple TV, possible Apple TV and what that means. And then also YouTube launched new channels. It's put at least $100 million into original programming onto channels with some celebrities and some kind of smaller name digital media folks, in an effort to kind of not maybe supplement people's TV watching. Who knows exactly where Google is going with this. They're also trying to revamp Google TV, so maybe that's part of it. So first, let's start with Apple TV, the Apple TV set, and the apps. Jason Kotke and John Gruber, a couple really well-known tech bloggers, started writing about, if there's going to be this Apple TV set, what happens if we had channels as apps? Then Dan Frommer kind of jumped in and also talked a little bit more about that and what he sees as the possibility and the potential for that. So let's bring on Dan Frommer and Brent Weinstein and see what their take is on this. So Dan Frommer is editor and founder of Splat F, technology news site. Previously, he helped create Business Insider. You can follow him on Twitter at FromDome. Our other guest is Brent Weinstein, who's head of digital media at the United Talent Agency, where he helped form the department in 2003 to oversee the agency's digital practice areas. Previously, he was the former CEO of 60 Frames Entertainment, a venture-backed startup focusing on original programming for digital platforms. Welcome to the show, guys.
Nice to be here.
Thanks for having me.
So first, we're talking about this idea of an Apple TV set, an actual TV, not just an Apple TV add-on. Dan, what have you heard about this actual Apple TV, the TV set? Is it a reality? Is it just a lot of rumors swirling around? What's the latest on that?
Well, it's something that people have kind of talked about for a while, partially because they seem to be going in that direction in a few different areas. First of all, the add-on to any other TV that they sell, the Apple TV accessory. But then also this giant 27-inch iMac that's right in my face right now. I mean, this is basically a small TV. I use it as one. So why shouldn't they kind of move into this other market that makes sense, putting a big Apple computer in people's living rooms. But kind of the latest thing that I think got people talking about it again was Steve Jobs' biography, where he says he finally cracked the TV, Basically right before he passed. So I don't know if that means that it's something that Apple will build next year or the year after or never, but it seems that they're at least thinking about it in a way that's more serious than they had been before.
So, I mean, cracking the TV, I mean, we all know, I mean, there's not much more you can do with it as far as a TV set goes. But my guess is that what you have to crack is how you get the studios and all the content people on board. I mean, you look at what happened with Google TV, and the biggest barrier to them was just getting people to accept it and make deals with them. How will Apple, I mean, that's what I would think would be the tough part about cracking it,
right?
Wouldn't it?
Well, first I'll disagree with your first statement. I think there is actually a lot that can be done to improve even just the basic TV experience. One thing is the remote control. If you look at the remote, right now I have, three remote controls sitting on my coffee table, all for different things, and they're all very confusing. They remind me of the old smartphones before the iPhone came out. Just lots of buttons everywhere that almost always are not being used, as well
right.
as, I don't know if it's going to look that much different, the actual monitor, but, there are things they could do, like add a voice user interface, like they just did with the phone, or video conferencing, turn the actual TV, not just into something that you use to watch TV shows and movies, but make it a home computer that's in the living room. The way they kind of smashed a phone and an iPod and a web communicator into one thing. So I don't know. We'll see. So in terms of the second question, which is, how are they going to change the way that TV content and entertainment is distributed? That's going to be, I think, much harder to crack because, that's an area where content is scarce. There are only a handful of major studios that are capable of making content that's of quality that people actually would want to watch. I mean, you see there's a lot of independent video that's being produced on the web, and some of it's tolerable, but a lot of it is garbage. And Apple, has seen over the years, I think, with their Apple TV add-on thing that, what they said is basically people want to watch Hollywood movies and TV shows. So that's definitely what they're going to go after, but that's hard. They're long-term contracts between networks and distributors that are worth billions of dollars over many years. So, some of it's money, some of it's time, and they can't just create that.
Yeah, Brent, what do you want to jump in here and talk a little bit about where, the talent sits? I mean, what you think some of the hurdles Apple would have in trying to make their TV efforts more successful?
I don't know if there's any talent hurdles per se. I think that the creative community has embraced Apple maybe more so than any other community on the planet. Go to any Earth Cafe or Starbucks in LA or New York, and you'd think that the Denizens there are sponsored by Apple. So I don't know if there's any talent hurdles per se. I think that there's certainly going to be business hurdles. I think that when you think of an Apple television, you think of being able to access your favorite networks on an a la carte basis, your favorite shows on an a la carte basis, maybe even, tapping into your traditional cable or satellite provider, through an app without needing a set-top box. And there's a lot of stakeholders in the value chains that traditionally deliver, create content and deliver it to audiences that are going to find that very upsetting. But I don't think the talent community is one that's going to have any objection. In fact, I think they're going to think it's really fascinating.
Why has it been so tough to get things a la carte? I mean, we all imagine and dream of the day where we can just watch what we want, pick the shows we want, pick the channels we want, and now I think some of the cable companies are admitting they might do some a la carte things. But I'm just curious why that's such a difficult thing, other than just they've set up the economics to bundle everything.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly not an expert on the cable business, so I don't want to play one on this, but
right.
The truth is that there's just a lot of really, really, really significant forces that banded together have a lot of leverage and have a lot of political capital. And, when you think of your typical channel lineup, if you have digital cable or satellite and how many of those channels you actually watch on a regular basis, imagine if all of those other channels got together to leverage that cable company saying you can't go a la carte, right? They know that we're not watching them, at least not all of us. And so there's just a lot of leverage to maintain the status quo. But I think that we're heading towards some version of an a la carte environment, whether people or the current administrations want to get there or not. It's just becoming too obvious that people are going to find ways to get the individual pieces of content they want when they want it on the device they want it on, and that, you know, we'll see if people ultimately, you know, become frustrated with having to pay for everything in one big bundle.
It's a pretty simple economic explanation as to why there hasn't been a la carte so far. I mean, let's just pretend we're doing the math with ESPN, which gets something around $5 per subscriber per month from every cable and satellite subscriber in the U.S. Say that 90% of people opted to not get ESPN as part of their subscription. Then those 10% that remain would have to make up the rest of that money to basically to fund ESPN's operations. So they'd be paying $50 per month for ESPN alone. And, you know, if you distribute that over a bunch of channels, some people pick these ones, some people pick those. Cable all of a sudden doesn't get cheaper. It may even get more expensive because just the way that the money has flowed up until this point. I don't know if it's sustainable to do this forever, but that, you know, that's why it's happened like this so far.
Certainly. I mean, I look at the channels that I watch, and if I had to pay for them, you know, on an a la carte basis, I certainly would pay more every month than what I pay today.
I think people don't appreciate what a good deal cable TV is, and even something like Netflix. Like, yeah, it's expensive, but based on how much time that people spend with it, it's actually pretty cheap. I mean, if you assume that people are paying, I don't know, $40, $50 a month for cable and watching 5 to 8 hours a day per household, that's pretty cheap, actually.
I think so. This is Rafa. So I think one point and then one question. I think when people talk about cable being expensive, I think a lot of us, and this certainly me as well, I'm comparing it not so much to online or a la carte. I'm comparing it to satellite, because the same number of channels in satellite, Dish, Direct are $30-$40 a month versus Time Warner Cable in New York City, which is $90 a month. So I think that's really where the consumer disconnect happens. But that's, I guess, a whole different show that I'm sure we can talk about. Dan, in terms of if, let's say, we are imagining Apple coming out with the TV, and you mentioned, you wrote this article about apps environment moving on to TV, and not just Apple TV. I'm sure all the other players in the market would want that to be the case as well. How do you envision it? What are the hurdles you think that will happen in that kind of environment? I mean, Roku box, which is a $50 box that I use and I'm a huge fan of, already has some of those. I mean, it's still very early stages, but has app-like environments there.
Exactly. And, you know, even Microsoft is actually doing probably more than Apple is here with the Xbox. They have plenty of channels, and they're even starting to do deals with cable providers so that you could use your Xbox as a set-top box. So, you know, software is totally going to reinvent TV over time, the way it has reinvented print media into online media and, you know, a lot of stuff like Skype, you know, that sort of stuff. But it's going to take some time. It's going to be a little weird. Like right now, your viewer relationship as a TV viewer is with your cable company and not directly with the channel. But here, all of a sudden, with apps, the channel or the company that owns all the channels, or even the host himself, like Glenn Beck has started, has the opportunity to reach the audience directly and bill them directly. So the balance of power has an opportunity to be shifted and toward the content creator and content owner, and potentially away from the kind of aggregator, which in this case, you know, up until now has been the cable company. But then you start to get into all these legal relationships, and then the biggest problem, I think, is that the all of this requires bandwidth, and the cable companies are the ones that have the most bandwidth. So at some point, you're going to be paying them. At some point, you might be paying the Travel Channel or something like that directly. And then there's, of course, Apple or Microsoft or Google in the middle, who's trying to process this payment. So it sounds like it's actually going to get messier than it is right now.
Yeah, I mean,
that might be a good thing, but it's definitely it's going to be very interesting and pretty complicated to watch, I think.
I mean, I think, you know, bridging from your initial question about Apple and a piece of television hardware, and maybe, you know, transitioning into, you know, some of the announcements that's been made about YouTube. You know, I look at the space today of, television and the availability of media, and it reminds me a lot of the mobile phone content business back in, 2006, early 2007.
Yeah, where there was all the phone decks and stuff that we were playing with.
Exactly. You had companies from all over the globe investing billions and billions of dollars in WAP-based protocols, delivery systems for content. Qualcomm had Media Flow. Sprint had their version. Mobile phone companies were buyers, and they were competing to who could get the best content. You know, if you were a content provider, you were struggling to get above the fold and onto the first page of the WAP deck inside someone's content application. And it was a mess, right? And if you had a game or a piece of content, you had to format it for 70 different devices per carrier. It was a complete mess. And then one day, Steve Jobs announced the iPhone, and it completely changed how we think about mobile entertainment. It became about apps. It became about the mobile web, and no longer was about WAP-based protocols. And literally in that moment, billions and billions of dollars of investment just disappeared. And I think that when the Apple TV is announced, I think that it has the potential to shake up the television business and the content delivery business for television the same way that the iPhone shook up the mobile business. And I think we're going to see a lot of companies that have invested billions of dollars in R&D and product for over-the-top devices and a variety of delivery systems. I think we're going to see a lot of that simply go up in smoke the second that the Apple hardware is announced. And I think, one beneficiary of that type of environment is going to be the producers of these new YouTube channels, who are effectively creating mini cable channels. And when they have the opportunity to be able to reach consumers as elegantly and easily as ESPN or the History Channel can reach people today, that's a pretty interesting moment in time.
So yeah, let's talk about the YouTube channels. YouTube spent reportedly $100 million on original programming. Brent, you're involved. Some of your clients are involved in that. What's the enticement in doing those channels, and what do you think the possibilities are there?
So the enticement for the artists are varied. The ability to create programming without a significant amount of oversight from Big Brother is always appealing. So YouTube, in this case, is really a network operator. They're the platform, and other than choosing their partners, they're really going to be fairly hands off in terms of overseeing the development and the production of the content. So for professional artists who are used to getting a litany of notes from network and studio executives and having groupthink often bastardize their original vision for entertainment, they're excited just to go make stuff and to be able to stick to their creative guns. They're also excited about ownership. Although a lot of details of the program haven't really been released, the visionaries behind these channels, the artists, have a great deal more ownership and control over the content at the end of the day than you do when you're dealing with a typical media financier, a network, or a studio. And that's always appealing. Anytime you can create something and then be able to still control it downstream, it's something that's very appealing to artists who are used to signing over the deed to their ideas very early on in the creative process. So between the freedom creatively and then, the upside that comes along with being a media owner, there's a lot of reasons why artists are very excited about this opportunity.
So, Brent, my question, follow up to that is, how is it? I mean, so YouTube, as you know well, has tried many times trying to sign up some of the premium content companies over the years, and to sort of very mixed success. How are the channels? If YouTube and Google are not putting any marketing muscle behind it, as you're saying, how are they really any different than any of your clients saying tomorrow, I'm just going to upload my video to YouTube? Is it just a matter of money that YouTube is handing over?
you know, without speaking for YouTube, because we've been, you know, warned very sternly that we're not supposed to, you know, I think that certainly the funding has a lot to do with it. If I had a client who tomorrow wanted to create content and put it on YouTube, one of the first questions they would ask me as their agent is, how are we going to pay for it? And if they wanted to create the volume of content that we're talking about here, most of my clients that are going to be working in this program are going to be producing, you know, somewhere between 30 and 100 hours of original programming annually. The question isn't just where do I get money to produce stuff, it's where do I get a bunch of money, right? So I think that the funding obviously is key. The fact that the funding comes from the platform operator is also important because, you know, YouTube is incentivized to do everything they can to make this work. And I imagine, although I don't know this and there's been no release, and so while certainly I'm on the record here, again, I want to reiterate I'm not speaking for them, I would be shocked if YouTube isn't thinking very hard about how they're going to restructure the environment that is YouTube to allow for greater discoverability of this premium content. And I think that what you'll see over the next year is a shift in the platform itself so that it, you know, hopefully supports this type of programming, but doesn't lose the special sauce that makes YouTube what it is in terms of the discoverability and all of that. So I think that they are going to be supporting these things in a very serious way, and that they have every incentive to make this work.
So Dan, I have a follow-up question. As somebody who watches the whole industry, this has been a year where so many things are up in air in the video front. I mean, last year, we thought things were settling down between Hulu and Netflix, and now all of a sudden, all of that is up in air because of all the stuff that you and I read about and cover and write. And then Amazon has entered the fray in a major way, and now Apple is trying to do it, and now YouTube is trying to do it as well. So like five giant players butting head against each other. As a consumer, what should we do? I mean, where do we even begin to wrap our heads around it?
Well, I think what'll happen, and again, I'm speaking, you know, I guess as a professional in the business, but really more as a consumer, as a guy who comes home at night exhausted from my day and wants to sit on the couch and just be entertained. I think that Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, you know, we're very quickly approaching a moment in time where all these companies are quite frankly the same, right? And just like people quite frankly don't have a lot of brand affinity towards their cable provider. You either live in a Comcast neighborhood or a Time Warner neighborhood. Maybe you prefer DirecTV. But the truth is you just get your content from wherever you get it. I think that if someone wants to watch Harry Potter or The Office, there's going to be so many different options that these providers are going to have to find ways to make their offering really unique, because just having the content isn't going to be enough anymore. And historically, what that's meant, people who've made their businesses initially on delivering, for lack of a better word, second-run entertainment, where they've all gone is towards original entertainment, HBO being the best example. It used to be a place where you'd go to see movies that were once in theaters, but now if you talk to most HBO subscribers, they could care less about the movies that are on the channel. They want Entourage. You know, they want Sopranos. They want Game of Thrones. You see Stars going in that direction, Showtime going in that direction, you know, Cinemax now even going in that direction. You see Netflix going in that direction. And I think what's going to happen is that in a world where I know I can get The Office everywhere, I'm only going to pay a monthly fee for something where I'm also getting something that I can't get somewhere else. So I think that in that regard, YouTube has been very smart. They've said, we know that we're a place where eventually people are going to be able to see all the traditional media company content that they want. But since they can also get that content through Netflix and a bunch of other sources, what are we going to give people that's unique? Why are people going to go to YouTube as opposed to go to somewhere else? And I think that investing in premium programming has been a successful business model. HBO has made it so. Netflix is certainly trying to go in that direction. And I think that people who don't invest in original programming are going to very quickly become an also-ran in this business.
It almost makes you think that Apple should have bought Pixar instead of Disney. But that was a long time ago when things were very different. I think I absolutely agree. And I think one of the things that might allow one of these companies to differentiate is software, which is, you know, I'm not crazy excited about the idea of trying to make television interactive or you know, awkwardly social. I do think there's some value to, you know, having Twitter on your phone while you're watching an exciting sports game or something like that, but I'm not sure how well that will be baked into the whole TV watching experience. But I think there are plenty of opportunities for, you know, a really great software platform to be the basis of the next entertainment system, which is, you know, somewhere where you can search through content very well, see what, you know, what the best and most cost-efficient way of getting this show is or that show, or, you know, the opportunity for a channel like PBS to not only deliver their whole library of video to me, but maybe other features, you know, I don't know, ebooks or something like that, or games or quizzes or something like that. And really, you know, just stuff that we haven't even imagined yet. So I think that software may actually be very important in the future of, you know, the whole experience. And I think that's where Apple and Google are probably the strongest. And I would say the cable companies are probably the weakest. And even just the media companies and content owners, you know, we'll start to see which of those can really learn how to be software companies and which can't. And I think the balance of power could shift there as well.
Yeah, Brent, I'm curious about one of the things you talked about, the YouTube being attractive to talent, is that they have a little bit more power. They have a little bit more chance to kind of, you know, be more creative. Are people in, you know, the talent business, are they still wedded to being, you know, I want to have a show on such and such channel, I want to work with such and such studio? I mean, how independent do they want to be? How willing are they to go directly to the consumer and you know, I guess a different business model that might not bring them the same amount of money?
I mean, you know, it's certainly not my place to speak with for every artist, but I think that generally there's very few instances where artists have, you know, brand loyalty in terms of studio networks, distribution platforms. I think that when you say I want to work with HBO, I think that means something, that stands for something. HBO has really worked hard to create an environment where, you know, the highest level people want to work there, even if they can make less money along the way. It's just a very creatively rewarding environment. They'll allow people, Game of Thrones is something that they spent years and years developing and producing in order to get it right, whereas most other networks would have, you know, given them a 4-month window to shoot a pilot, right? So I think that outside of a few examples like HBO, Adult Swim, and others, I think people have very little loyalty or affinity towards certain distribution brands. Now, I think they feel that certain brands will help them get to certain audiences, right? If you're doing a stand-up show, you'd rather be on Comedy Central than the Travel Channel. If you have a cooking show, you'd rather be on the Food Channel or something of like that rather than MTV. Right. But other than feeling like it's a means to an end, I don't know if people have preference. And I think that if artists felt that they could get directly to consumers without going through those traditional means, they'd be very excited about it. The big questions have always been, great, who's going to fund it and how are we going to market it? And marketing, you know, if YouTube's answered the funding question through this initiative, you know, the marketing thing, as was raised earlier, you know, in this conversation, is the one big question mark. I think that Angry Birds is a fantastic example of how, in the right environment, in that case, Apple's operating system, a piece of exceptional content can be as popular as, you know, the biggest media company franchises in the world. You know, and I think that artists are looking at that and saying, okay, why can't I create a linear program or an interactive experience that is just as popular as something like Angry Birds? You know, but people don't want to just get lucky. So what people have to figure out over the next few months and probably years is, how do you figure out marketing? How do you, in a world where instead of there being 400 cable channels, when there's 4 million, right? And when you can access, you know, Rafat TV or Brent TV just as easily as you can ESPN, you know, the question will be great, but how do you tell people it's there? How do you get them to come back? How do you condition them that this is something that should be part of their lifestyle? And if we can answer that question, the floodgates open pretty rapidly, I think.
No question. Well, thanks, guys. Appreciate you joining us for the show.
Thank you.
This is great. Thanks, you guys. We can do a whole channel just talking about the future of
Yeah, where's our $100 million YouTube channel, Rafat?
That's what we should
do. You guys need better agents.
Yeah. That's true. We do need better agents. Anyway, thanks, guys. This was great.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. Along with co-host Rafat Ali, we want to thank our guests, Dan Frommer, as well as Brent Weinstein, and our sponsor, the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism, as well as PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Don't forget to keep up with all the news, polls, and events over at PBS Media Shift at pbs.org/mediashift and our sister site, Idealab, at pbs.org/idealab. We'll catch you next week.